Welcome to Kicking It with Raphael here on World Football Daily. It is our 10th episode of the season. It's been a great season. A lot of great guests from England, Africa, United States, even China last week with Christopher Atkins. And today we'll start out of Budapest, though we never know where this guy is going to be because he's obviously always traveling around the world. It is my pleasure to welcome on James Montague, the author of When Friday Comes, Football in the War Zone, and releasing his new book called 31-0, The Story of World Cup Qualification, which will be published in May 2014, and is going to be great because it's just been about all the stuff that we're actually going to talk about today. So welcome, James. Thanks again for coming on.
That's great. Great to be on.
I want to start off and talk about the match that you were at, Jordan against Uruguay. I spoke about it a lot because I thought I'd be there, but I couldn't make it. But we knew you were going to be there. There was a lot of excitement within the country. In your article in the New York Times, you spoke about the country's been divided lately. And I think the main focus of your article was that the country came together. So if you can kind of follow up on that. I think that our listeners would find that very fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, I've been following Jordanian football for a while now. You know, I mean, when I first released When Friday Comes, Football in the War Zone, the Jordanian chapter very much focused on how football kind of reflects. I mean, the whole book's about that, you know, like how football reflects society. And in Jordanian society, what a lot of people don't realise is that there is a tension within Jordanian society that's not often spoken about between, you know, the Jordanian East Bankers, you know, the those that conceive themselves the true Jordanians, and the Palestinian Jordanians, which actually make up the majority of the population because of different waves of immigration that have come after various wars that Jordan has fought with Israel. So over the years, there's been a kind of a majority kind of Palestinian population, and in the football league, that's really reflected in the big rivalry in Jordanian football between Faisali and Wahdat, Wahdat is the team of the Palestinians, and Faisali is the team of the East Bank kind of Jordanians. So what's been interesting is that division is not really spoken about in society at all. It's very restricted. I mean, when you look at the royal family, King Abdullah, you know, that he has tried to overcome that. He's married a Palestinian American, Queen Rania. Prince Ali, who's on the FIFA Expo and heads up the Jordanian Football Association, he's half Palestinian. So it's just a really big issue in society, and it's really quite divisive. So what was interesting for me is you had a national football team which hasn't really performed at any level in the past that has players that have their roots in both communities.
Right.
And what I'm fascinated in is how national football teams, and you saw this with Iraq in the 2007 Asia Cup when they won it. You know, you had a multi-confessional team of Shia, Sunni, Turkmen, Kurds who are Sunni but obviously of a different ethnic group. So you had them coming together for a greater goal, which although there's problems in Iraq, I think was important psychologically at a time when Iraq really was at its lowest ebb. And what's fascinating for me was how this football team had got its way to the Asia qualifying, beat Uzbekistan in the playoff to reach this stage where it could play Uruguay and was only, 180 minutes away from the World Cup. I mean, even asking questions to Hossam Hassan, the Egyptian coach, and even to Prince Ali when I was there, that it was still a very touchy subject. I mean, I would recommend all your listeners to go and check out the WikiLeaks archive, looking at all the cables that were released by them. And even when you look at the US embassy and the ambassador there, you know, even there's several cables there which talk about this division and some of the violence that takes place at the matches. People who'd been killed at these games, largely because when you look at it, the security forces are, there are no Palestinians within the security forces or the upper echelons of the army. The matches that I've seen between the two teams when they play, the two league teams, Wahdat and Faisali, it's very much, you hear chants which are, pro-Palestinian on the one side and kind of not quite anti-king, but certainly on the other side, urging the king to divorce his Palestinian wife and many anti-Palestinian sentiments. So, yeah, check out the WikiLeaks. There's some really fascinating cables there by the ambassador, or allegedly by the ambassador. Obviously, the Americans have never officially recognised that this is all true. You know, that looks at exactly this issue. So, I mean, it was important enough to be mentioned at a diplomatic level. It was important enough, I think, to look at it in the context of this football match. So yeah, it was fascinating to be there because of that. But you know, obviously, Uruguay are a pretty tough team, so it was a pretty tall order for them to reach Brazil.
Yeah, but you know, speaking of the match, let's get to that now. What was interesting was the Jordanians had plenty of chances. I mean, they in the first half, I'd say. Second half, they seemed kind of, you know, they'd come back down earth. Though the score, what was it, 3-0 at half?
Actually, I think it was 2-0 at halftime. Maybe it was 2-0 at halftime. I can't remember. I mean, it was so many. I think it was 2-0 at halftime. They had their chances, you know. And the problem is they had a severely weakened side. Their first choice goalkeeper was suspended. Deeb, who's the probably the best known and most decorated player, probably best player in the team, he was suspended as well. And you saw in the second leg when they came back, I know Uruguay, you know, had effective. He qualified by winning that match 5-0, but the match ended 0-0. And especially at the start of the second half, you could see King Abdul actually came into the stadium and gave the whole stadium this lift. And you could see the players, it gave them a lift as well. They had a fantastic, Hayal had a fantastic chance. Where he should have, it would have been easier for him to score, and he missed it in front of the Uruguayan fans. And you think 2-1, you know, if they could have restricted it to 2-1, possibly, you know, to 3-1, they might have had more to play for in Uruguay, you know, 5 days later. But as it was, you know, they kind of fell apart. And once the third goal went in, I think it was all over for them, which was a shame. But, I mean, people have been quite unfair, I think, on Jordan, saying, well, this is ridiculous. Look at the standard of Asian football. Uruguay took them to pieces. And Uruguay played exactly how a kind of overdog should play an underdog in a scenario like this. You know, they kept their powder dry, they kept organised, and they picked them off. But it's always dangerous in that kind of scenario. If a team then breaks through and scores, you know, it changes the whole complexion. Do they then push more people forward, leaving space? But you know, I think Uruguay, you know, and Oscar Spires played the match. I mean, he set his team up perfectly for it, and with a bit more luck, I think it would have been a bit closer. But as it was, you know, 5-0, maybe not an accurate reflection of the result, but I think it's an accurate reflection of the dominance in chances and the, you know, you've got up front for Yann Suarez and Cavani, and you've got £100 million worth of striking talent there, whereas you've got, you know, a Jordanian side that most of the players play in Jordan, a few of them play professionally in Saudi Arabia. But it was a tall order, and I think, you know, I don't think anybody would disagree with a 5-0 and a 0-0 result over two legs.
Right. I mean, the second leg, I think, you know, is just resting on Uruguay's part and so on. But I want to ask you, James, from being in the streets before the match, you know, after the match, obviously the score, they lost and people knew it was over. But before that, Jordan is a very, very small country. I think, 4 or 5 million, the smallest, smaller even than Israel, smaller obviously than Syria. Very well educated. They have a lot of universities per capita. But what was the energy like on the street or when you were in the stadium? Because when I was watching it on Eurosport, the announcer would just say people were going crazy the first, you know, 10, 15 minutes, and that was when it was 0-0. People, you know, there's been a lot of talk about the Muslim Brotherhood, you know, trying to overthrow the king in Jordan. But what was the atmosphere like, you know, in the streets before the match? I know you were there a couple days before.
Yeah. You know, I mean, everybody was waiting for the game. It's probably the biggest thing that's happened in Jordan, you know, not culturally and socially for a long time. And I remember going to on the match day itself. It was just this incredible atmosphere. You know, it was kind of chaotic. It's a huge security event, if nothing else, because you've got to remember, like, Jordan is a you know, the quiet man of the Middle East. You know, right. It's, you know, when you look at what's happening, you know, you have the West Bank, you know, to the west, to the east, you've got Iraq, to the north, you've got Syria, to the south, you've got Saudi Arabia, and it's you know, you have jihadists. You know, it's a place where other people take their problems to Jordan, and then the fact that it has any kind of stability and safety at all is testament to its security forces. I mean, it is incredible that, you know, really since Black September, you know, when the PLO had made, you know, it caused so many problems within Jordan, since then, you know, the fact that it's managed to keep any kind of security and a peace agreement with Israel, as fractured as that is sometimes, is incredible. So you can imagine that the security and the chaos on the streets, you know, people trying to get to the game, and there was just these black clad officers just, you know, wearing Kevlar and you know, taking no prisoners. So getting to the stadium, it was just this incredible kind of atmosphere, but also this incredible chaos at the same time. And I remember when I went to the ground, and I, you know, there's a confidence as well. There was this huge confidence that they would win. I'm not sure where it came from, but the funniest part was going to the Uruguay and the meeting Uruguayan fans, and it turned out everybody was from Israel that I spoke to.
Right.
You know, there was most of, you know, I'd ask some guy's name, and it'd be clearly a very Jewish name, and I was like, where are you from? It's like, oh, we're from Tel Aviv, you know. And you know, there's one guy I spoke to who was born in Tel Aviv, but his father was Uruguayan and hadn't been to Uruguay since he'd made Aliyah, and he'd been at the famous 1950 American R, you know, World Cup final between Brazil and Uruguay, one of the greatest upsets in the history of the competition, where Uruguay won the World Cup, and Brazil famously believed that they were gonna win it, and even printed some newspapers beforehand that they had won it. You know, and he was there, and he had his Uruguayan flag that he had on that day in 1950, and was there, you know, waiting to go in, and the first time meeting Uruguay since then. So it was emotional and chaotic and you know, just full of great stories.
Yeah, it sounds like it, and it's also amazing, you know, on TV, you were there, so I don't know what you got to see, but on TV they kept showing the reaction of the king and, of course, the prince, who is very big with FIFA and, as you said, the head of the Jordanian. Is that something that, I mean, the royal family was there. It seemed like everyone was there. It wasn't just, you know, the king and the prince. There was a whole group of people there, diplomats and so on.
I think it was really important. I mean, things like this, and that's where I think football, soccer has this huge role to play, is that, you know, they can be, certainly with national teams, moments of, you know, national unity. And I think it was really important for the royal family to be seen to be there and to show a face, you know, of unity of these two kind of competing communities society to come together. So I think it was really important that he was there. But obviously, because in a way, kind of Prince Ali symbolised the union of Palestinians and Jordanians. Certainly, Prince Ali's half Palestinian. Again, like I mentioned, King Abdullah was there with Queen Rania by his side, with his children by his side. So I think it was important that he was visible. You could see that when he entered the stadium, that was the moment that really coincided with the best passage of play for the Jordanians. You know, you could see the players responding, you could see the crowd responding, because actually the Uruguayans have done a great job of silencing the Jordanian crowd.
Right.
You know, once it was 1-0 up and it was looking really tough and they weren't getting much traction, you know, the noise dipped down and it got very quiet. But when the king was involved, you could see how important it was, not just a football match, but as an event for the country, an event for him to try to show that, you know, that these divisions didn't matter. I think it was quite a symbolic event, yeah. And it would have been even more symbolic if they'd won.
And from what I remember, James, wasn't he not wearing a Jordan? He was wearing a jacket, and then wasn't he not wearing the national team jersey under it?
I didn't see him. He was sitting right in front of me. I could see him down. I could see he was going a little grey at the temples. I remember seeing, and his wife was there, who is potentially one of the most beautiful women I've ever seen in my life. Pretty much, you know. She was sitting there, and you know, he was living it. He was living every kick, but I couldn't see whether he was wearing a top or not.
Okay, let's move on to Iceland, which a lot of Americans who might be listening to this segment know is a party country where people from New York, you know, I think it's a three and a half hour flight and go live it up in this country of 315,000 people. I think, you know, James, it's fair to say it's a little bit different than the Jordanian team, just because we do know that there are players on this national team that play for not huge clubs, but they do have good players that play in Europe.
You've got players like Gilfie Sigurdsson, who plays for Tottenham Hotspur, who's had some great seasons in the Premier League. You know, you've got I think Bogason Sig Thorsen especially, who plays for Ajax, scored goals in the Dutch league this season, although he was injured for the second game. You know, and then you've got players who plays in the Serie A, and Gunnarsson, who plays for Cardiff. Everybody apart from the goalkeeper, who, by the way, when I interviewed him, he has a brilliant story because he's a film director, and he's the only player that plays in Iceland, and who's still part time. So he sees himself as a full time film director. So wow. He was out there making. He actually made the kind of Iceland Air advert for where all the team came together, and he filmed the. He was the director of the 2012 Eurovision Song Contest entry, and he's in the middle of making a horror film. So it was interesting seeing the team, which is very professional, and actually, you know, the system in Iceland, even though they have 300,000 people, 300, I think it's 360,000 when you take all of the diaspora into account as well. The system there is churning out huge amounts of talented professional players that can really play, maybe not at the Champions League level, but certainly in top leagues across Europe. And you think, it's incredible that they're producing this amount of talent. So for them to get this far, if you look at per capita, it's an incredible achievement. But I think it's deeper than that. They have a system of coaching and talent spotting and nurturing that I think every country in the world could look. I mean, if you've got a team the size of the United States going and poaching, you know, Aaron Johansson, who has been, this isn't a guy who has Icelandic lineage and has lived all his life in the US. You know, he was born in the US, so qualifies for a passport, but grew up in the Icelandic system with Icelandic parents, was coached in the Icelandic way, and the US have poached him. So you've got a nation of hundreds of million people, you know, poaching, because the coaching system is so good in Iceland, poaching players from them. So that's how many they're producing. And you think, well, if you put the US into a European qualifying context, I think they would probably struggle. So for Iceland to come through a group that had, people say that it was quite weak, but if you look at Switzerland, you know, they're top seed to the next World Cup. And actually, when you see them play, when you've got Jerdan Shaqiri, you face him, I think he's one of the most underrated players in Europe. And, Gorkan Inler, you've got Barami, there's a huge amount of Kosovans that play for the Swiss team. Granit Xhaka, actually, we're probably the best, one of the most technically best teams that I've seen playing throughout the qualification period. And then you have Albania, okay, should have beat them. Slovenia, who have qualified for the finals before. But to come through that, which I think the US would struggle. I think the US and Iceland would be a great game, and I would imagine probably Iceland probably win.
Wow, that would be fascinating. I mean, since they're so, distance-wise, they're so close to each other, and back in the days... In the 50s and 60s, I believe you had to, if you were from New York, you'd have to fly from New York to Canada to Iceland to then London. So interesting, very interesting stuff there. You were at the match. Again, I want to ask, the match ended at 0-0, but there is hope. What was interesting that you said, James, was that you said you don't really know why the Jordanians had the hope that they could win. But with the Icelandians, wouldn't you say the opposite? You completely understood why they thought they could win?
Yeah, I think so, because, they had a coach as well, Lars Lagerback, you know, Swedish coach. He's taken Sweden to two World Cup finals, coached Zlatan famously, so he's a big personality that he's managed, took Nigeria to World Cup finals, so he's got plenty of experience. And he set up a team, very quite a rigid 4-4-2, but very well organised. And you know, over that qualification period, I think they lost once away from home. So they went, you know, and Iceland had never hosted a game in November before this, so the potential was for like a terrible, you know, snowstorm, which apparently the snow fell the day after, a few hours after the match finished. But the conditions were pretty good, you know, it was above freezing. And you could see from that performance that actually, 0-0, they lost Sigfosson in the first minute of the game, in the last few minutes of the first half. And then in the first few minutes, the second half, we're down to 10 men, and actually restricted Croatia. You know, this is a team we had. You had Olic, Mandzukic, you had Modric, who plays for Real Madrid, who didn't actually have a clear cut chance. So you're thinking 0-0 going into the second leg, have lost one game away from home in qualification, had some incredible results, including they were 4-1 down to Switzerland and drew 4-4. During qualification, which was a fantastic result, and you could see them going to Croatia, they were confident, you know, talking to them beforehand, talking to the fans beforehand. You know, I think 1,500 Icelandic fans turned up, which is something crazy, like 0.6% of the population. You know, you could see that they were very confident, but then, you know, it was very clear. You've got to remember that Croatia as well, I mean, since the end of qualification, they've got rid of their Stimac, who they got rid of. It was the worst, in terms of points, the worst qualification campaign since they became an independent nation. Brought in Niko Kovac, it was 0-0 in the first leg, but I mean, Croatia was superb in the second leg. Absolutely superb. And Iceland had to be at their best to go and win at the Maxima in Zagreb. And you know, it was the worst I've seen them play. Lots of individual mistakes. I mean, Gylfi Sigurdsson, one of the Icelandic journalists I spoke to afterwards, I mean, Sigurdsson is very much the beating heart of the team. He's a very advanced role, and he's the creator for everything. I mean, he couldn't put a decent pass together. He was at fault for giving away possession twice for one of the goals. And one of the Icelandic journalists said to me, you know, he lost the ball more in that game than he has done collectively in the entire qualification process. And then I think equally, you know, up front, they brought in, what's his name? They brought in a good Johnson, who started the game, and with, it's completely, the striker. The point was that Kolbjørn Sigfosson had been injured in the first game. And clearly, he was the pivot around which the team worked. You know, when it came to their attack and moves, and he was sorely missed. They had nothing to stick up front, and especially when you're playing away from home. And it was a real shame that their performance was really below par. And I think that was the most disappointing thing, is that I think the pressure got to them. And they even, if you look at it, they even were down to 10 men, Croatia, after a deserved red card for Mandzukic. And they still couldn't put it together. And it was really sad. I mean, at the end, Gudjonsson, you know, broke down to tears because he was pretty much his last match. He was 35 years old, last match of the Iceland team. And, it was, as you expect from a Nordic nation, they were very magnanimous in defeat. And Lars Lagerbäck said, you know, it was hard to take, but it's not hard to take because the best team won, and that's all that mattered.
Yeah, I mean, what was so fast? 300,000 people, just to remind people that number. It's unbelievable. Now, Croatia, at the same time, not really the biggest country in the world, but 4.5 million people or 5 million people with superstars like Modric, who plays for Real Madrid. But it's really fascinating how this country of 300,000 people have people playing in Serie A, in the Dutch league, in Russia, in Portugal, and like you said, Tottenham, Ajax, Club Rouge, these are top teams in their nations, and it's just a country of 300,000 people. It's baffling. So my next question for you, James, as a guy who really knows world football well, are we about to go into an age where these teams that were weak in the past are just going to get stronger, and every single match now is going to get hard? Or am I, you know, taking it one step too far? Or how would you see it?
I think you're right. I mean, there is. I'm dealing with this at the moment with 31-0. You know, I feel like traveling around the world for the past 3 years that I've kind of caught something that's not going to be something that's going to that's changed forever. I mean, I've grown up with international football and with minnows in international football, very much being part-time players. You know, you go to the smaller nations and you know they're not professional, and this is something that soccer has professionalized, you know, successfully and kind of taken over the world. And you'd have these minnows who would be priests or delivery drivers or mailmen, you know, and they'd play football, and you know, you kind of have this, you know, same with the FA Cup in England, you know, you have these kind of part-time amateurs, and they kind of represent the spirit of football in a much purer sense. But I feel like I've really caught the end of that. You know, every team is professionalising, every team is developing its football, so that in the future, kind of, you're not going to have any really amateurs anywhere in the world, but football has been so successful in spreeding its gospel worldwide, that you're just not going to have that. And I've been really lucky to see teams like American Samoa, you know, and Tonga and teams like that, that really are the last generation of these teams that are going to have their roots in the kind of amateur past of football. With Iceland, what I think is interesting is the way they've approached their small numbers and their, you know, the small talent pool, and how they've extracted the maximum amount of wealth. Really, every small nation has got to look at that and take heed from that. I mean, I think a lot of every Icelandic person I speak to, one of the big things they said was the Icelandic mentality. And I can kind of understand that, certainly with the Nordic countries, Scandinavians and Finland as well. There's a hard work ethic and a collectivism to their society that kind of breeds people that work hard, and there is no haves and haves not in that society. And it kind of, if you have a collective game like football, I think that's really important. But what's important is that they've invested money into, you know, I think it was seven or eight indoor state-of-the-art full-size pitches, which means that they're playing football not just in the summer months, but when the weather wasn't allowed, like usually they'd play out in the winter in the snow, which obviously isn't great. So they're now having two professional seasons, competitive professional seasons a year, which is meaning these kids are playing a lot of football. All their coaches are being coached to UEFA B and UEFA A standards. So every kid who's got a slightest bit of talent that we would probably, you know, at school, there'd be a teacher who just, you know, kicks about school and, you know, you'd be playing in the school team. The moment you show any kind of aptitude, you're being coached by somebody who's got their UEFA badges, which, you know, partly can only come about because there are so few people in the country, but also the fact that they are making sure that everybody has those qualifications and everybody has the ability to play all the year round. And I think every small nation should look at that and realise that, you know, there is potential there. And I mean, in a way, Iceland lost, although they had a fantastic run trying to reach the World Cup finals. They didn't make it, obviously. I mean, they were really the smallest nation to ever qualify. But another result took place, which probably many people don't in America, in Israel, probably missed out on, was the fact that Gibraltar, which recently got, you know, much to the Spanish horror, with Gibraltar being a British-owned territory on the you know, southern Iberian Peninsula, they were, UEFA were forced to admit them as a member because they'd applied years ago, and despite the Spanish opposition and political opposition, and UEFA changing the rules on what countries can enter into UEFA, specifically to stop Gibraltar, they had to let them in. And they're now the smallest nation in Gibraltar, smaller even in UEFA, smaller even than San Marino.
Wow.
Not a nation, but kind of territory. And they drew 0-0 with Slovakia in their first ever game in Portugal. And I think that is a huge result as well, because Slovakia, World Cup qualifiers, huge amount of history there. And when they're part of Czechoslovakia, won the European Championships, you know, mainly with Slovakian sides. There's a lot of talent there, a lot of players playing at the highest level, and yet you've got a team like Gibraltar that could shut them out 0-0 in a friendly. And I think we're seeing an age where if people can follow the development and invest money in the right way, smaller nations are going to be able to level the playing field with bigger nations.
Yeah, I mean, we saw it here in Israel. The Israeli Football Federation. I mean, I know this is completely off, but it kind of goes with what you're going. The Israeli Football Federation started to invest more money and time in our women's national team, and last night we beat Serbia 3-1 in a World Cup qualifier, which, you know, 5 years ago would have been unheard of, since we barely had any players playing pro, but now our goalkeeper plays professional football in Holland and so on. So really, you know, it sounds like globalization, and what's fascinating is if you know, these little nations can tie with Slovakia. Do you think, and this is, we'll end with this question, James, do you just think that in, you know, 20 years, football could just be in an all new level where you have a match like Portugal against, you know, I'm trying to think of a good, Iceland or you know, small country, Slovenia, which made the World Cup, and it actually will be very even because just these smaller nations have, you know, have less people to take a look at, so they can develop their people straight away. Where in these big countries like England, you know, sometimes you miss guys or you make mistakes.
Yeah.
You said, I mean, the money that it, I think the money, the infrastructure, and so on. We're seeing football infrastructure being built even in Africa, in Western Africa. They're starting to build better pitches because they know that you know, scouts from England are going to come. And I really, it's just globalization is really the thing I think of. And I think it just can completely change the level of football. I don't think it could do it in basketball or in hockey or in tennis. I really think football. So we'll end with that question.
I mean, why not in those sports? I mean, essentially what this comes down to is an argument or a discussion about nature versus nurture. You know, about the talent gene. You know, are people born with talent, or is talent something that's coached? And, you know, was it 10,000 hours you have to invest in a given talent for it to come to fruition? And it's a question that I asked a lot of people in Iceland, and it's a question I've asked for the past 3 years while I was researching 31-0. And it's clear that through coaching, through hard work and application, and all those things coming together, that you can build you know, a talent pool of players that can compete, maybe not win the competitions, but can compete against traditionally bigger nations. Now, there are always players that are born with a God-given talent, you know, and I think where you have bigger countries, I think it's more likely, obviously, because of the statistical probability of it, that you're going to find those diamonds, the Ronaldos, the Messis, you know, the George Weahs, you know, these players that have this talent that seems that it doesn't matter where they were born or what physical imperfections they have, you know, the talent they have kind of rules out. And I think if you're a country from the size of Slovenia, you know, obviously the odds that somebody will have that talent are smaller, but we're certainly going to see a much more level playing field. And certainly when you see the way that FIFA are going in terms of the money that's being invested in Asia, I mean, certainly Blatter and many people in FIFA see that as the future. I mean, there's an argument at the moment going on about whether more World Cup places should be given to FIFA, which I think most people are against at the moment. But there is no doubt that in 20, 30 years, those countries, you know, are going to catch up with the rest of the world. And suddenly, I think you're going to have a much more level playing field, not just between the smaller teams and the larger teams, but also between traditional outposts for football. I mean, I think Oceania, I mean, I'm writing my chapter at the moment on American Samoa, and I think Oceania is, you know, is not quite a basket case, but it's going to be certainly a lot harder work to try and get teams like Tonga and Samoa, you know, places where football is actually probably the second or third sport behind gridiron and rugby league, you know. But we're going to see in the next 20 years, you know, a greater level of playing field between the giants and the minnows, and also between east and west and north and south. And I think, again, this is a byproduct, but I think a quite positive byproduct for globalization.
Well, it's absolutely fascinating. Everything you just mentioned, we spoke about with Christopher Atkins, who's based out in China and was covering the Champions League there, and was just talking about how, you know, a lot of the guys who played I can't pronounce the team, but Evergrande. There you go. Yeah, I can pronounce Evergrande. People know what I'm talking about, though. I think he said 7 players on that starting 11 play for the Chinese national team. The Chinese national team is trying really hard to get Lippi right now to leave his job there, but he's under contract there. And you just look at the money, the infrastructure that Chinese football could give, and the capabilities. And for the first time, a team from China won the Champions League, the Asian Champions League. So,
China's a bit of a difficult situation because for years people have looked at China, and certainly I think Blatter had one eye on a Chinese World Cup, thinking that would be a fantastic way to boost football in this market, because you've got to think, it's not just, you know, we take it a little bit for granted that football is this, soccer is this world game, and that it's obvious that the Chinese will fall for it. Actually, what's happened is, because of endemic corruption in Chinese society, and also the fact that it was very difficult for people in the past, under the more kind of extreme forms of communism, to form a team, because it was illegal for people to have gatherings of greater than 5, I believe. And there's a great book about this. I'll dig it out, the name of it. They looked into this about how it was very difficult for Chinese people to actually form 11-a-side teams. That basketball has been far more successful, and the NBA in particular, has been far more successful in building courts and getting kids to play basketball than in soccer. Because, the national team, for a long while, there were accusations that you had to pay bribes to get on the national team. You know, which is, you know, international sports should be the most meritocratic of businesses. You know, but if it's down to what you can pay, then obviously the national team is going to suffer. And China has had an abysmal record on the international scene. And basketball has been on soccer's heels, looking to overtake it as the most popular sport in China. So seeing that they've turned this around, they've put a lot of money, obviously, into the league, and hoping they're dealing with match fixing and also the bribery culture there. If China can awaken and Lippi can take charge of the national team and obviously choose a team based on merit, then I think that could have huge effect as well. But I mean, it's strange thinking of China as a minnow, given that statistically you'd think there would be 11 incredible players in there somewhere that could play for them. But at the moment, they're playing basketball.
Exactly, and we could say the exact same thing about India. India has really developed their basketball program. They've sent a lot of guys to play collegiate basketball in the United States. James, as we said before, we could go on forever. Always a pleasure and always very fascinating interview that always goes longer than expected, but always a lot of fun. Everyone should check out your book. Again, it's coming out in May, right?
Yeah, 31-0. It's coming out in May, and yeah, basically I've been following the World Cup qualifiers for 3 years, so it's the story of the underdog, the little guys trying and ultimately, I guess, failing, trying to reach the World Cup finals. But as with everything, it's never the destination, it's always the journey.
Absolutely. And to follow him on Twitter, James at James PIOTR, James Montague. Enjoy your time in Budapest, and we will be in touch. Thank you so much.
It started snowing, so I don't think I'm going to enjoy it that much. I need to wrap up. I'm going to get a blanket or something.
All right, that was James Montague, who's working on some very, 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 very cool things. He's going to have a new book out in May 2014 about his journey across the world, Iceland, Croatia, Jordan, everywhere. He really traveled everywhere in the world, so that's going to be a fantastic book, and it was great to have him on. Next, we're going to welcome on from Paris, Jonathan Johnson, a French football journalist based in the beautiful city of Paris. Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Hi there, Raphael. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a pleasure. There's been so much talk about this match that occurred. What was it? It seems like weeks ago, but it was, last Tuesday, less than a week ago, about what was that stake for this team. I mean, we know that 94 in the United States, they didn't make it, but can you talk about just being around the city of Paris, what the atmosphere was like going into the match, being down 2-0, knowing that if they don't win, 3-0, that is it. I mean, this team is not going to the World Cup with all the talent that it has, all the youngsters that it has, veterans, the way Ribéry has been playing for Bayern Munich, all these things piling up. What was it like before the match? Just what was the talk radio like? What were you hearing from other journalists in Paris?
Well, the funny thing was about the build-up to the Ukraine game is that it was really, really mixed. In the immediate aftermath of the defeat to Kiev, everybody was so negative. The team was absolutely savaged for its performance, and rightly so. It was an awful showing. They were truly shocking, perhaps lucky to even come away with just a 2-0 defeat. But somewhere along the way in the build-up to the game, something changed, something clicked, and the media and the French public in general sort of went from massive pessimism to this wave of sort of slight optimism and belief that the team could turn this around and reach the World Cup. It was really strange to see the way that it changed. There were so many negative things said about the team, and it was almost like everybody had vented their frustration at the side. And then after that, they decided, well, you know, this for France, if they don't make it to the World Cup, there's so much at stake here for the players and for the people that cover French football in general in the media. There's so much at stake for all of these people that there's nothing else that we can do now except support the team, get behind them, and just try and roll them on to an incredible comeback, which is eventually what happened. But it was funny how it just sort of, there was a snowball effect. The first sort of couple of chinks of positivity sort of started to creep in, and then all of a sudden it's just everybody latched onto it, and by the time the game came around, everybody was just raring to go. The Stade de France was jumping ahead of time about an hour before the kickoff. The atmosphere was already fantastic. It was an absolute sea of colour there, and it was like people went from despair to sort of unbounded hope, really, in the days building up to the game.
Yeah, that it just seemed amazing how things quickly, you know, flipped, I think is the word. What were your initial thoughts when you saw the starting 11 that the French decided to go with?
In Kiev or in France?
In Paris.
Well, in Paris, I think everybody felt the same thing. I think we all felt that this was the lineup that Deschamps probably should have sent out against Ukraine in Kiev. He went for a 4-2-3-1 in the away leg, and they obviously came away with a 2-0 defeat. There were some controversial selections made. Mathieu Valbuena was dropped. Sami Nasri was kept in the starting lineup for that game. And defensively as well, Eric Abidal was played in place of Raphaël Varane because Varane was struggling with a knee injury at that time. He didn't add an extra third midfielder. Yann Cabaye started the game on the bench. And those changes for the first leg were corrected for the second. Cabaye came in, had a fantastic match, and I think he was probably, for me, one of the best players on the pitch last week. Rafael Buena also came in, and he was absolutely crucial. His set-piece delivery in particular was absolutely fantastic. Looked far more comfortable in the team than Nasri did. And, of course, Benzema came in place of Giroud. I'm not going to say that I think Giroud was... should have been dropped for the first leg. I think it would be very unfair to say that he has deserved to lose his place in the team just on the back of a couple of games where he's perhaps not scored as many as Karim Benzema. But at the same time, you know, he sort of earned this chance to start ahead of the Real Madrid man. And I think, you know, Giroud would be the wrong scapegoat to pick out ahead of that game. But the lineup was absolutely perfect from Deschamps ahead of the home leg, and it showed on the pitch with a 3-0 victory.
How important do you think Matusako was to the match? I mean, it's amazing to think this was only what is 15th or 16th appearance on the French national team. He's a really young guy who's now starting to get a little playing time under Brendan Rodgers at Liverpool. But how important was he for this victory?
Yeah, I think he was very important for the victory. I mean, the key thing with Sarko is playing in Paris, Sarko is going to have massive support, obviously, because he was born in the city, grew up, then came through the ranks at PSG, captain PSG, the youngest captain ever, actually, in fact, of the capital club. Sarko and Paris are synonymous with one another in football terms. And I think just the fact that he was playing was enough. And the fact that it was him that managed to get the two goals, that was a massive, massive boost. In terms of you know, what he brings to the team playing-wise, I think he was probably a better choice than Eric Abidal. I think in terms of ability, it's hard to see Laurent Koscielny still not being first choice alongside Raphaël Varane. Varane is a superb player, very talented, young, so, you know, a little inexperienced, but he doesn't do that when he's on the pitch. You know, he looks like, he plays like he's a veteran, you know, and he's still so young. And for me, Sarko at the moment is third choice in the national team. Although this may now have changed Deschamps' mind and shown him that he can perhaps rely more on Sarko than he can Koscielny.
let's move on now to the World Cup. Do you think that the strikers, Giroud, Benzema, and Remy from Newcastle, are, you know, world-class strikers who can lead their team, you know, deep into the World Cup? Because I think that's a concern among, you know, people who support France at these three. Giroud has a lot of goals this year for Arsenal. He scored a brace this weekend. Also, Remy, I believe, scored a goal, a big goal for Newcastle. Either it was this week or last week. Benzema, you know, just these three guys, it's a giant question mark. Do you just think that they're enough to really cause damage to other teams in the World Cup?
Do I think that the three players are world-class? No, I don't think any of the players will be in that top bracket of strikers in world football. Now, Giroud, Benzema, Remy, none of them are a Zlatan Ibrahimovic or a Falcao or a Robin Van Persie. You know, they're not consistently prolific enough to be classed in that bracket just yet. I think Giroud has the makings of a top quality striker, but doesn't always show it. For me, Benzema actually is not necessarily a striker, certainly not for the French national team. I see him more as a number 10 in that side, and I'd be quite happy to see Deschamps finally experiment with playing Benzema behind Giroud and not having to go for one or the other. Benzema is not a prolific goal scorer at international level. He scores more goals than he does for France, for Real Madrid, but I think that's more a product of the team that's around him than, you know, the way that he actually plays his game. Benzema is a player that likes to drop deep, come pick up the ball in the midfield, and that's something that France have never really tapped into. They struggled so long now to replace Zinedine Zidane, and plenty of players have come and gone with this tag of the next Zizou. But one player that's never been tested in that position is Karim Benzema. Benzema is a creative player. He brings a lot of his teammates into the play, but can't always find the net when needed. And that, for me, suggests that, you know, he cannot lead the line on a regular basis because he's not going to score enough goals. Remy perhaps can, but Didier Deschamps has coached him at Marseille, and he often played out wide there for them. He's now doing very well leading the line for Newcastle. I think he has a legitimate shot at being one of his first choice players, but between the three of them, do I think that they're good enough to perhaps lead France to World Cup glory? No, I don't think they are. And I think that the only way that France are going to succeed in this World Cup is if Deschamps can find some way to get the best out of Benzema and the best out of Giroud at the same time, because then and only then are France going to have a genuine goal threat. I think it would be quite naive to think that all of France's problems have been solved with this victory over Ukraine in Paris last week. This is still a team that struggles to score goals. It's a team that really struggled in their qualification group. And I think that Deschamps has so much that he needs to change ahead of the World Cup if France are to succeed, not only in Brazil, but also in Euro 2016, which is held in France 2 years later.
Right, and there was such a big concern that if they didn't make it to this World Cup, that match would be considered really competitive matches because they're already qualified. Let's talk about these young guys. You already spoke about Mamadou, and you spoke a little bit about Raphael. But Paul Pogba, who's been in the news and in the media for being so brilliant on the pitch with Juventus. From what I watched, I wasn't that impressed with him with the national team. I know some people were, but that was just my opinion. Do you think that a guy who's 20 years old with so little experience could lead a midfield also in a World Cup? And we know we have Ribéry, but also he kind of seemed to disappear for a guy, especially in the first leg, for a guy who, you know, is claiming that he should win. What do you think about this midfield? I mean, also a lot of problems in the midfield, in my opinion. What do you think?
Yeah, I think I'd agree there are some issues there. Franck Ribéry is a player who has always performed at club level, particularly for Bayern Munich, but has never replicated that at international level. You know, rarely do we see the Franck Ribéry that you see week in, week out, playing for Bayern Munich, you know, conquering everybody domestically and across Europe. We've never really seen that from him in a French shirt, and that's one of his biggest criticisms, and perhaps will be the eventual reason that he doesn't win the Ballon d'Or for this year. Of course, Cristiano Ronaldo has perhaps blown him out of the water with his individual performance against Sweden to qualify Portugal for the World Cup. Ribéry didn't do the same. With Pogba, Pogba is still very inexperienced at international level. He's growing into the role, and I think he's done very well so far. I wouldn't say that he's been particularly outstanding in any of the games so far, but having him in the midfield alongside Matuidi, there's already signs there to suggest that France's midfield, central midfield, going forward towards Euro 2016, and perhaps even beyond that, is already sorted. Matuidi and Pogba, two very promising upcoming talents who will no doubt be among the best in the world in their position, if not in the next year or two, then certainly by the time 2016 rolls around. In terms of the other talents to come in ahead of the World Cup, you remember we've still got Antoine Griezmann to come once his international ban expires on the 31st of December. He'll be you know, a massive plus for Didier Deschamps once he's available for selection again. You have the Marseille duo of Gianelli and Mbula and Florian Thauvin. You also have Geoffrey Kondogbia at Monaco. And people have even forgot that Josua Gilavogui, who's now with Atletico Madrid, was making his way into the France team when he was at Saint-Étienne and then secured a late move in the summer transfer window to Atletico. That move is perhaps now hampering his progress on the international stage. But this squad was also devoid of players like Maxime Gonalons, the Lyon captain. Then you also have Etienne Capoue, who's recovering from injury at Tottenham. There's so many players that could be brought into Deschamps' squad ahead of the World Cup. You've got the likes of Lucas Digne as well at PSG, the left back. There's plenty of problems on either side of the defence with Deschamps to try and solve. Digne is seen as perhaps the solution to the troublesome left back role. Whether or not he plays regularly enough for PSG ahead of the World Cup to justify starting ahead of someone like Patrice Evra, that remains to be seen. But I think he should definitely be included in the squad. And there's another couple of youngsters as well who should arguably be on the plane into Brazil. You've got the likes of Kurt Zouma at Saint-Etienne, who's now suspended until January after a 10-match ban for a horrible tackle a couple of weeks ago when Saint-Etienne were playing Sochaux. You've got Eliakim Mangala as well, the defender from Porto. And you have another couple of players in Ligue 1 particularly who have a point to prove. And then you have the likes of Morgan Schneiderlin at Southampton as well, a player who has proven himself in the Premier League yet has never received a single senior cap for France. So Deschamps has plenty of options ahead of the World Cup, and I don't think it will be an excuse to say he didn't have the right sort of players at his disposal in France if they're going to underperform in Brazil next year.
So how would you suggest he goes on selecting these players? Does he watch how they play for their respective clubs? Does he stick with the team he has? I mean, what do you expect us to see? If you were to guess, what would be the starting 11 come, you know, June 15th of this summer?
Well, unfortunately, there is always the big question mark hanging over the mentality and the personality of some of the players in this team. I don't think Deschamps is going to fully change the side. I think he has to get rid of some players and bring others in. I think, for example, someone like Samir Nasri has had his time in the French national team now. I don't think he should really be seriously considered for selection again, given the trouble that is associated with him, particularly at international tournaments, and the fact that he's just not doing it on the pitch. I think going forward to the World Cup, there's a couple of players in the team already guaranteed of their places. I think Lloris is assured of his role in goal. It's very unfair to say he's sort of played any part in the troubles over the last couple of years when France have underperformed. He's one of the best goalkeepers in Europe. I know his form over the weekend in conceding six goals perhaps isn't going to be the best thing for his case right now, but then you've got the likes of Rafa Varane in defence as well. I think he will be one of the starting players for this Cup. It wouldn't seem to see Sarko usurp Koscielny as well centre-back, I think we'll still see Patrice Evra going, even though I would debate taking him to another international tournament, given the trouble he's caused in recent years. And I think Debuchy will start at right back as well. Then in the midfield, I think we've got Kabay, Matuidi, Pogba, as we spoke about. And I think the starting lineup for the first French game at the World Cup may well be very similar to the team that we saw take on Ukraine last week at the Stade de France. I think Valbuena will go, Giroud will go, Benzema will go. And I think for me, it's got to be an opportunity for Deschamps to bring in some of the young players now that he's looking towards for Euro 2016 and give them the experience of being in a big international tournament so they're ready to deliver when France hosts the Euros 2 years after the World Cup.
All right, let's move on right now to Liga 1. And I wanted to ask you, in Israel, people are very excited for how Enyema has been playing because he played for Lille. That is, he played in Israel for a long, 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 long time. And the media in Israel would always say, how does this guy not get more attention in Europe? He's been terrific with Nigeria. In the last World Cup, he was fantastic. Argentina played Nigeria, and he's just such a great goalkeeper. I see that he won Player of the Month this year over Zlatan Ibrahimovic. Is he finally getting some credit for his goalkeeping?
Yeah, he is. Enyama has been absolutely superb for Lille so far this season. What they're doing at the moment under René Schiedal is absolutely incredible. But Enyama is a big part of the fact that they have only conceded 4 goals in their opening 14 games. That's a new record in the whole history of French top flight football. That Lille side with Enyama in goal now has the best defensive record of any top flight French side in the history of French football. That's majorly impressive. Enyama's played a big part in that, and I think he's only a couple of games away now from the Ligue 1 record. It was set by Gétien Houard. He went 1,176 minutes without conceding a goal. Enyama is only 321 minutes away from equaling that and possibly going even better. And at the moment, the way that Lille are playing, they just look impregnable at the back. And I think that Enyama is a big part of that. He looks so much more composed than Steve Ilana, who was the former number one at Lille. When Enyama arrived, he was quite unlucky. He was behind Mikael Longo, who is still third choice for the French national team. And then Ilana had been brought in at the same time. Ilana did well for Brest before the move to Lille. So he was given a chance before Enyama. And I think Enyama was right to look for the loan move and to go back to Israel. But I think Schiedal has come in and seen that Rudy Garcia didn't perhaps rate Enyama that highly, but Gidard probably had his eye on the Africa Cup of Nations and how Enyama performed there, and maybe even listened to some of the rave reviews he was getting in Israel, and has not regretted making him first choice goalkeeper. And I think the Player of the Month award for him over the likes of Ibrahimovic and Cavani was justified, because at the moment he's arguably been the revelation of the season.
Yeah, and it's people here are very excited. And of course, he played in Europe. That's the thing that was the most shocking, is that he played, deep into Europe. He played in the group stages. He played even in the knockout stages with Hapoel Tel Aviv. And still, I remember he was on loan a little, but he didn't get any playing time, so he came back here. But it's good to see that he's doing well. Okay, this is something I very much wanted to discuss with you. And a lot of people have been asking me to talk about this with a French football expert. We've seen Monaco and PSG take over now, even though Lille, are still there and Marseille are still there. But what is it like right now within the French media to see these two clubs that, Monaco has a great history, but PSG have struggled over the last, decade or longer. What is it like for these other teams that we're used to seeing as, the star teams, Marseille, Lyon, Bordeaux, which I see is all the way in 12th place, and even Montpellier, that I believe Montpellier won a couple of years ago, they're in the top, they're all the way in 16th place, close to relegation. I mean, how are these teams, how are their front offices taking this that PSG and Monaco have so much money, you know, can outbid them on players, can take their Champions League spots, can take the Europa League spots. Because I mean, to me, it just seems, you know, every year you are the ones that compete for Europe and compete for the top four to make it to Europe. And now suddenly, as I mentioned, Marseille still at number four, but Bordeaux is at 12, Lyon is at 7. You know, help us understand that a bit, if you could.
Well, I mean, the teams that you see now challenging for Europe just don't deliver when they go on the continental stage, with the exception of PSG, who got to the quarterfinals of the Champions League last year. You know, the teams that represent France in Europe generally underperform, so I don't think that they can have any problem with PSG and perhaps Monaco taking France's European places and going forward in the future, because at the end of the day, two teams with that amount of money are going to go far in some of the biggest tournaments. So that is going to boost France's coefficient ranking, which has fallen below that of even Portugal in the last couple of years, which is just, you know, it's unthinkable for a country of France's stature. France now only has three Champions League qualification places, and even the third spot forces that team that finishes there to have to go through qualifiers in order to reach the Champions League. And that's where Lyon were knocked out against Real Sociedad this year. France is a competitive country in terms of Ligue 1. We've had six different winners over the last six seasons, and no team has really been able to establish themselves without the aid of financial backing from either Qatar or Russia, and win back-to-back titles. You know, gone are the days that Lyon dominated the league, won seven straight titles in the early 2000s. It doesn't happen anymore. France is too competitive a league to be able to do that. Before PSG were taken over and before Monaco returned to Ligue 1 with new investment, Ligue 1 was a league where anybody could beat anybody on their day. It was very competitive, and you'd often see relegation decided on the final day of the season, involving like eight teams, all of them battling against going down on the final day of the season. And quite often, thing would happen with the European places. Okay, the title might have been decided one or two games before the end of the season, but the European places, and certainly the relegation ones, are always very very, very closely fought and go right down to the wire. I think that for French football, PSG and Monaco are absolutely vital now, because given the 75% tax that's about to come in, is supposed to be about to come in at the moment, we're still waiting to see exactly what will happen sometime next year. But at the moment, it looks like François Hollande is dead set on introducing this taxation. PSG and Monaco are more important than ever, because they will be able to ensure that French football continues to thrive in Europe, and eventually the teams that qualify for Europe will be able to gain enough money through that, outside of PSG and Monaco, to be able to compete and to be able to bring in the same quality of players, so that French football can actually start flexing its muscles on the European stage.
And what team do you think we should look out for that's in the bottom right now, maybe in the bottom six that have been playing pretty decent lately, and you expect them to maybe try and get in the top four?
It's difficult at the moment to pick out the teams that you know are really underperforming, because I think when you see the likes of Montpellier down there, yes, it's surprising considering that they won the league just 2 years ago, but at the same time they've lost a lot of talent, and you know they're in the middle of a rebuilding stage at the moment. I think Nice are a team to watch. They've got a new stadium now, good coaching, Claude Puel, very vibrant team, possibly one of the most underrated shows in world football, in my opinion. Darius Vitanich, never been capped at international level for Argentina, he scores, you know, bagfuls of goals for Nice in the Young. I think you've also got the likes of Bordeaux, again, you know, a team that has suffered for the success that it's enjoyed in the last couple of years. All of their big talents sort of sold off and the money not reinvested, which they're struggling now. And you have them as well. They managed to poach Philippe Montagnier from Real Sociedad in the summer. He's struggling at the moment to get this Rennes side really performing and getting back up to the top, the top half of the table. But you know, their team to watch in the second half of the season, if some of their players start clicking, particularly Roman Alessandrini, I know he got rave reviews last season when he sort of burst onto the domestic scene with Rennes, then got that horrible injury in February. Player since, he was called up to the French national team just before he got injured, wasn't able to make an appearance, and if he can get back to the same another player who could not only help Rennes to European qualification but could also feature at the World Cup of France or certainly the Euros 2 years later. Then you've got Lyon, who are recovering from a bit of a patchy spell recently, but again, they've struggled because they've sold off so much of their talent over the last couple of years. Lyon bring through a fantastic number of players from their youth academy, but they sell them off and don't really replace them because they don't spend the money that they earn from these players. You've got Saint-Étienne as well, who were doing so well last season, led by Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, and now with Aubameyang leaving for Borussia Dortmund. You also had Gilles Avogui poached by Atletico Madrid in the summer. They've lost two massive players, so they're sort of struggling to find their way into the top three, sixth place at the moment. But then you've got the likes of Marseille as well, who were expected to make a title challenge perhaps because of the players that they brought over the summer. And now they're down in fourth, 6 points off of second place Lille, and 10 points off of PSG in top. So, their title bid faltering at the moment, but they have plenty of talent in that team. So I think all of those teams can legitimately look at European qualification, but some are struggling at the moment, given the things that they've had to do in order to survive. French football is not particularly affluent, and some of these teams have to sell their top talents because they have no other choice.
Interesting. Very, very, very interesting. Jonathan, we got to run, but where can people check out your work, and what's your Twitter in case people want to learn more about the beautiful game in France?
You can find me on Twitter at John_Legosip. That's John_Legosip. You can find my work on ESPN FC, Bleacher Report. You can also find me doing stuff for the likes of beIN Sport USA as well.
Very cool. Jonathan, we really appreciate your time. Very fascinating stuff out of France. And love to have you back on once we get the French draw and we see who the French will face in the World Cup.
Cool. Looking forward to it, Raphael. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much. All right, that was Noah Davis from Grantland, America Soccer Now, and a lot of great other places discussing the United States, Clem Dempsey, Landon Donovan, pretty much every player on the U.S. team. Interesting stuff about where Onyewu is playing right now, and with Maurice Odu. A lot of these guys were very important players for the 2010 team that now are struggling to even get playing time in Europe. So good stuff there. So we've hit a lot of things today. We spoke about football around the world with James Montague, and then the big France match that occurred in Paris last Tuesday with Jonathan Johnson, who is a Bleacher Report and ESPN FC France football and Ligue 1 correspondent. And now ahead of the big matches tomorrow night and Wednesday night, it is my pleasure to welcome on a Fox Soccer commentator and pretty much every week guest, Mr. Mark Serber. What's up, Mark?
Not much. How are you doing?
I'm good. Excited for some Champions League. We seem to have a lot of exciting matches this week, as usual. But at this point in the stage, Mark, only two fixtures left before we head to the knockout stages. For most of these second place teams, it's do or die. So we're gonna go through every single group, break everything down, and that will be our show. So let's start off with Group A right now, which Manchester United have 8 points, Bayern Leverkusen have 7 points, and Donetsk from Ukraine, Shakhtar Donetsk, have 5 points, and Real Sociedad have 1 point. So we can take out Real out of the mix, theoretically. Technically, they're not out, but we're just going to, and we're going to focus on these three teams. We've spoken about Donetsk in the past, just with the how strong they've been with the money they've had, with the Brazilian players they've had, and on. We remember last year United's failures in the Champions League, in addition to City's failures, and we'll get to City later. But Bayer Leverkusen are a very solid team. This week's fixtures are Bayer Leverkusen against Manchester United in Germany, with United just coming off not the best match against Cardiff. So with that being said, what do you think of this match? I personally am going to just have to go with Bayer Leverkusen just because of United's form this past weekend, and just I'm not confident they can go into a very good German team and beat them in Germany.
No, I think it's going to be very hard, but the thing we have to remember is that Manchester United have seemed to kind of raise their game a bit when it comes to the Champions League. At the same time, they can win this game and still not secure first place heading into the final game of the Champions League group stages. However, I think you're right. I think Leverkusen is going to cause a big threat, but United definitely need the points, because I really don't see Real Sociedad beating Shakhtar Donetsk at the Donbass Arena, which is a really tough place for any team to play, let alone a team that only has 1 point heading into the final game. So if Real do end up winning and United win, then Real Sociedad still has a chance at making it to the last 16, but I doubt that that's going to be going to happen. I see Sociedad being done by the end of the day, and I still see it being a three-horse race. No matter what happens in the Leverkusen Manchester United game, they'll still both be up for a spot heading into the final match day.
Yeah. I mean, you said it about playing in Donbass Arena in Ukraine. It's really, really, really tough. As we mentioned, probably one of the better, you could argue one of the best teams in Europe from one of the smaller countries, just success-wise in Ukraine and in Europe of late, with all the talent they have had. Real Sociedad, I think they had a coaching change this offseason. We spoke about it earlier in the show. So they haven't been the same club since last year. Moving on to Group B, which an amazing group. Galatasaray, we know, with Didier Drogba. Copenhagen are still around for getting that victory. What was it? 2 weeks ago over Galatasaray. Big victory for them at home. And then Juventus all the way at the bottom with 3 points, which is a bit shocking. They have not won a fixture yet. They have tied 3 fixtures and lost one. So they have 3 points all from draws. They haven't really been playing that well defensively. Especially their match against Galatasaray and Copenhagen. Especially Copenhagen, that was very disappointing for the fans in Turin. So this week we got Real Madrid Galatasaray, which, it should be exciting with the names that Galatasaray have and the coaching staff that they have. Mancini, of course, at Galatasaray. And a very interesting thing here, Mark, it would be pretty ironic if Mancini can get Galatasaray into the knockout stages when he couldn't do it at City, right?
I was just going to say, you have a Real Madrid team that's starting to hit top form. They have Ronaldo's, obviously, what he's been able to do for club and country. You have Bale, who's starting to overcome his problems, and he's looking more comfortable. And it looks like Ancelotti's side is starting to click a little bit. Now, they just need a draw against a Galatasaray team that, like you said, you put Mancini in charge of, and he has trouble getting out of this first round. And then you have a Juventus team that they just went to the top of the table in Serie A with a win, and it looks to me like they're starting to hit top form. And even though I think Copenhagen have caused miracles so far, I don't see it happening. So I see that Copenhagen losing this one in Turin, a very tough place to play in the Alps, and I see Real Madrid getting at least the draw, if not all 3 points. So at the end of the day, I see that Juventus up to six. I see Galatasaray either at four or five, and I see Copenhagen still chasing. But once again, this is another one where for three teams still chasing that second spot, that's exactly what you want to see heading into the final two games, because you don't want the last day especially to be a wash.
Yeah, well, what's interesting is Galatasaray is going to play Juventus in Istanbul at Turk Telecom, which I've known a lot of people who have been there that said it's a ridiculous atmosphere. And with the way Juventus has played with drawing all these matches, it would not shock me if Juventus can't come out there with 3 points. So it's really really important for them to take care of business versus Copenhagen and at least make sure they have 4 points going in and hope that they can at least get a draw in Turkey. It seems like they have a lot to play for, Juventus, and it's interesting them being at the bottom of the table with the recent form that they've been playing in. And Copenhagen, I think, are done, as you suggested. But I'm actually going to go ahead and call the upset here, and even though it's really not an upset, but I think Galatasaray is going to go through just because I think they're going to get a big at least 1 to 3 points at home in the last fixture and maybe get a tie at the Bernabeu, but I doubt it. We'll see. It's going to be very exciting. But the storyline, if Mancini can get this team through, you know, a Turkish team in a relatively tough group, I think that'd be very, it'd be kind of like the City fans wouldn't really understand how he wasn't able to do it with all the talent there.
It'd be a patient for him, but at the same time, look at what Pellegrini has done with Manchester City already through with two match days to spare.
Right, and we'll get to them soon, but first we'll move on to Group C, which seems to be kind of the most, besides PSG, most of the teams here are from smaller countries. Obviously, some teams that are very, very dominant in their countries, but so this is an interesting group. Anderlecht out of Belgium are out for sure. Benfica out of Portugal are still somewhat in the hunt. And then right now, PSG have 10 points and Olympiacos from Greece have 7 points. That being said, our fixtures coming up. Anderlecht against Benfica in Anderlecht in Belgium, and PSG against Olympiacos. So what do you think, Mark? I mean, can Anderlecht somehow get back the game with 3 points in Portugal?
I think so, depending on the fact that Benfica hasn't really done this well in this Champions League. Looking at the Paris Saint-Germain match, they just need a draw to ensure that they go through. So I think that they'll be looking for that and possibly more with the win. They had a win at the weekend, so they're in very good form. Olympiacos lost the last time these two teams played in Greece, 4-1 to Paris Saint-Germain, so they'll have their work cut out for them. But if they lose and Benfica can get 3 points away to an Anderlecht side that's pretty much dead and buried, then we have a whole new ball game heading in to that final day for that last place, for that second place behind Paris Saint-Germain. So I think that this is a game that Benfica definitely need, or else Olympiacos will most likely go through as runners-up. So Benfica, I have them winning, and I actually have Olympiacos putting up a tough fight, but I see Paris Saint-Germain getting the point that they need. So then it's all to play for going into that final day for those two teams, Benfica and Olympiacos.
Yeah, and with everything that's going on in the Greek economy right now, they could sure use a team going through, and of course their Olympiacos also has good club teams in other clubs, handball, basketball, and so on.
Well, also remember that Olympiacos has Mitroglou, who heading into the first leg, remember the goal scores in the second leg, but after the first leg for Greece against Romania had 22 goals in 20 games in all competitions.
Wow.
So this is a player that can score, so Paris Saint-Germain have to be wary of him.
Yeah, definitely. Even though it's in Paris where they've been playing pretty well, of course, as we discussed in our earlier segment with Jonathan out of Paris, PSG right now in first place over Lille by 4 points, I think 34-40. So they're really good as of right now. Same with Arsenal. Arsenal in the Premier League by 4 points at the top. Well,
the thing you have to remember as well is when Paris Saint-Germain play in Ligue 1, teams pack it in and make it very hard for them, and it's very tough for them to play. But this is a side that, as we saw last year, with the trouble they gave Barcelona, is very much built for the Champions League, because a team like Olympiacos that's searching points to try and push away from Benfica, that's trying to tie Paris Saint-Germain, they're going to come out, they're going to play open, they're going to press forward, at least try and hit on the break if they do pack it in. So Paris Saint-Germain are a much better team in the Champions League, even than they are in France, where they're the title holders, because they have space to play, and that's why they're so much fun to watch in this Champions League.
All right, let's move on to Group D, Bayern Munich, Manchester City, CSKA Moscow, and Victoria Pleasant out of Czech Republic. They're out of it. CSKA Moscow, they're out of it technically. So I guess right now these two teams are moving on, which is very exciting for Man City. First time in their history they're moving on. And well, I mean, what you kind of spoke about earlier, it's been all Pellegrini. We saw them absolutely trounce. We saw them absolutely trounce Tottenham earlier this week. So, what do you think we can expect from City going forward?
I think it'll be tough because the one thing that we kind of were a bit harsh on Mancini is the fact that his go-arounds in the Champions League, Manchester City, had really tough groups. This time around, you have Pilsen, you have CSKA Moscow, who I expected to give much better resistance against Bayern Munich and Manchester City, but were unable to. So I think Pellegrini had a rather easy group. However, Manchester City kind of tend to live and die, as we've seen this in the Premiership, by the way Pellegrini wants to play. And it worked against Tottenham. It hasn't worked against some of the lesser lights. And so it just depends on the draw going forward and what kind of Manchester City team shows up. Because to me, they're kind of very Jekyll and Hyde. They're not always the consistent team that's going to defeat teams 6-0. So I think that if the draw is kind on them, they can go far depending on the teams they get. If they draw Bayern Munich, which obviously they won't because they're in their group, but if they draw Bayern Munich heading into the round of 16, then it's going to be a really interesting proposition for them to see if they can go beyond just the group stages this time around.
And they certainly have the talent with all the new players they brought in and the players that they had last year, especially Aguero, off to a great start. Group E is very fascinating to me just because I really think that Basel are a very, very talented team with Mohamed Salah, who I really think will be I think he'll be somewhere much bigger than Basel, no offense to them. I think we could see him join a top Premier League team or a top team in the Bundesliga. He's very talented, still very young, and has a lot more to play for. That being said, it's going to battle with Schalke and Basel, and they both have pretty Schalke is going to get points from playing the Romanian side in Bucharest against the top club there. But Basel's going to have a tough time against Chelsea, though. It is going to be at home. And this is a game where they can get 3 points, beat Chelsea at Stamford Bridge. So they should have the belief that they can win at home. That being said, I'm not going to go ahead and call that. I'm going to stick with Chelsea just because I think we've seen their strikers play better lately. I think the midfield is improving, and I think that straight up Mourinho won't let this loss happen this late into the Champions League.
And remember, this is Basel team that not only did in Chelsea on the first day at Stamford Bridge, like you said, but it also has knocked Manchester United out in recent seasons of the Champions League too. So this is a team with a good European pedigree, with players, like you said, like Salah, like some other players too, who are very capable. At the same time, though, Chelsea has won their last 3 Champions League games on the trot. I don't think Mourinho's going to let this one go. And even if they lose, Chelsea's still in first place, but I don't think that still Mourinho's even considering that. So they don't want to have to do any work on the final day. And I think what you're going to see here is you're going to see Chelsea win, you're going to see Schalke win, and that means that both teams are going to be progressed to the next stage before the last game of the group stages in Group E even take place.
Right, and last game, you know, Basel have a tough round. They have Chelsea and then Schalke in Germany, in arguably the toughest place to play in Germany, ahead of Bayern München and ahead of Dortmund. So, you know, one of the top places to play in the world. So they have a tough mission. But let's say this, Mark. If they're able to get 3 points at home in Switzerland and then able to go to Germany and get 3 points, and they certainly deserve to move on to the knockout stages.
Yes, they certainly do, and they're a team that has played some really good soccer. So you look at certain groups where you see 3 teams, sometimes even 4, those proverbial groups of death, where you don't want to see a team not make it to the knockout stage, and I think Basel's one of those teams that you don't want to see miss out because they can always cause a shock when it comes to two-legged football.
Group F, Mark, was at the time named as the group of death in the Champions League, but Marseille hasn't been able to live up to the hype, even though they made a lot of big moves in the offseason. Again, we spoke about this with with Jonathan, and they start off that campaign in disappointing fashion, losing to Arsenal, then getting waxed by Dortmund, then barely losing to Napoli, and then barely losing again to Napoli. So actually, this team is very capable. They don't have any points, but they've played Napoli close twice, and they played against Arsenal close at the beginning. Though football is football, you got to win to move on. Still, this team is capable of beating any of these teams. I really do think that with the talent they have. Arsenal will welcome them to the Emirates on Tuesday, tomorrow night. And Dortmund will play Napoli, which I think might be the game of the week in Champions League, in my opinion. I know there's some other games that people are excited about, but this is the one I'm the most excited about. Napoli have not played that well in Serie A the last couple weeks. I think they've lost two in a row. They seem to be struggling. They seem to be losing some form. This is a great way to come back. They have 9 points. Arsenal have 9 points. And Dortmund have 9 points. So really, first place is technically wide open here, depending on what happens. I mean, if Arsenal loses their two next fixtures and Dortmund wins and Napoli wins, I mean, you know, I guess that can't happen. But there's a chance that Arsenal can move on, though very unlikely. Arsenal-Marseille, I think, you know, Arsenal's just been playing way too well lately. And, you know, we see Giroud, who scored a brace last week, or this past week, I guess. We saw him on the French team, and he's just been in great form. So I'm going to go with Arsenal. And Napoli and Dortmund, it's a tough one, Mark, because I think Napoli's desperate for some points here because they have not been playing well domestically at home. At the same time, Dortmund's coming off a disappointing loss to rival Bayern München. So I'm just going to have to go with Dortmund here and hope that they're not losing two fixtures in a row. What do you think?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that Marseille doesn't have a chance against Arsenal. They've lost their last 4 trips in North London, so this would extend it to 5. I think, like you said, you talked about Giroud. I think Aaron Ramsey's also in top form right now, as well as many of their other players, and they're just playing with a bunch of confidence. I think Dortmund and Napoli, like you said, Dortmund's coming in a little wounded. They're going to look to get back, but they also need this game more than Napoli, considering that they only have 6 points and Napoli have 9. So it's going to be very tough, especially considering the way that Napoli has played. But they have Rafael Benitez, who I think is one of the best tacticians when it comes to the Champions League. And so I think that this is really the game of the round, is Dortmund versus Napoli. Because if Arsenal win and Napoli win, then Dortmund are in real trouble. So that's something that this is do or die for Borussia Dortmund right now. And I think, in terms of Jurgen Klopp and Rafael Benitez going at it, one of the best, not only best matches you'll see in terms of the spectacle, but also in terms of the tactical battle and the tactical battle lines that these two teams will draw up heading into the game.
And Group G, one of the most interesting groups, because besides, I mean, you even could argue Atletico Madrid aren't a powerhouse team. They're not, you know, one of the best clubs in the world. For the most part, every group has a superstar team, and I guess you could say Atletico Madrid are that team, since they have been in the top of La Liga for the past, you know, years. But still, you know, they've been terrific. They have not lost a match. They've only given up 2 goals, which is really amazing if you think about it, in Champions League. But at the same time, the competition here, Mark, St. Petersburg, Zenit, Porto and Austria Yen, which is actually Terrence Boyd's team, I believe, the young American German who's playing for the American national team. So Atletico are moving on, but there's a battle right now for second place, and it seems like all teams still have a realistic shot to make it. Zenit plays against Atletico Madrid, and Porto plays against Austria. Who do you like here? I mean, this is kind of a tough group that I don't know that much about these other teams.
First of all, Terrence Boyd plays for Rapid.
Okay. Rapid, my mistake.
No worries. I see the Rapid is kind of a bit of a lame duck in this competition. If I'm correct, I don't think they have. Yeah, they've yet to score in this tournament, and I just don't see them going into the Drogão and being able to do anything against Porto. I see Porto just too much firepower, too much quality, taking all 3 points this one. That's why for this one, Zenit really need to lift their game, because they're a team that's been very hit or miss. When they're on their game, they're on, and they've been doing really well domestically. But in the Champions League, they've really disappointed at times. were lucky with their win over Austria, and at times haven't been the top team considering the players that they have. They need Hulk to be in top form. They need Axel Witsel to be running this midfield. But they're playing an Atletico Madrid team that's already through. So it depends on which kind of Madrid team shows up. Is it a team that's just kind of there to get this fixture out of the way? And is that enough for Zenit to have their quality overshow Atletico Madrid? So I think what it is not only what can Zenit do, but this is a test of Atletico Madrid's depth, which will show us a lot as they go further into the season and have to deal with both the Champions League and La Liga as well.
Right, and the thing that's interesting about this is that Hulk has been talked about a long time. There's a lot of criticism when he left Porto to go to Zenit St. Petersburg just because he had options to go other places. We know he got paid really well. But this is really his chance, Mark, to shine against a team which, you have to think that with the battle, in La Liga with Real and Barcelona, that there's no way that they'd want to, play all their players because they need to rest them, because it's, as we said with Andy West last week on the show, it's a long, long season, and you need to make sure that your players are fully rested and that, it's not worth it. They're going through. That being said, I really think it's time. Hulk needs to come through. They need to get 3 points here, and they need to move on to the knockout stages. They invested a lot of money in this team, and they can't afford to lose. I mean, it's at home. I think it will be the B team. I don't think Costa's injured. Villa might not play. I believe Costa's still injured. He was injured, but I don't think that Villa will play at his age. There's no point for him to play, or maybe he'll come off the bench. So I think Zenit Petersburg has to come through. With Porto, I fully agree with you. The Austrian team, as you mentioned, has not scored a goal and has given up 8 goals. Moving on to Group H, which you'll be covering tomorrow night for Fox Soccer. A lot of exciting stuff here. Another very exciting group with Barcelona already moving on, and Milan, Ajax, and Celtic, all teams that, are superstar teams or that have the history and vision to be considered superstar teams. It all starts tomorrow night, Celtic versus Milan. And we talked about this before the interview, Mark. Milan are really, really struggling right now. There's a lot of talk about, what is there to do, what is there to do about them, and how do we fix things, and what not a better way, Mark, than to win a Champions League against Celtic in Celtic Park, which, again, another tough place to play in that part of the world.
I think any team becomes vulnerable when they go into Celtic Park. I think that's one of the best atmospheres for a European night. And with AC Milan, and after their last game in which they scored an early goal through Kaká, gave up a goal just a few minutes later, Balotelli missed a penalty, and their own fans blocked the exits that the team leave through once they get out of the locker room to try and leave the stadium, demanding a meeting with the AC Milan players, saying that they're not giving enough, they're not trying enough. So I think that a win against Celtic would be the perfect tonic. However, I see Celtic, they play with so much strength, so much desire, and really lift their games for these European nights. So I see Milan having a really tough time. I think a draw and keeping themselves ahead of Celtic would actually be a good result for them heading into the final match day. Barcelona need just a point to secure top spot, and they have players that are on top form, such as Alexis Sanchez, who's done really well. They have Neymar, who's playing well. At the same time, just as I said that, Sanchez won't even be making the trip to Amsterdam. Valdez, Alba, Alves, Dos Santos, Athletic, Tello, and Messi are all out through injury. So if there's any time for Ajax to claim a famous victory, it would be now. The fact that they're missing Messi and Sanchez, who have the same amount of goals, and the fact that Pinto is in goal. And even though Pinto has always been the backup for as long as I can remember to Valdez, I've never quite understood it. I've never thought he was that great of a keeper. But with that many injuries, I think that Ajax really has a chance to strike. So this group is wide open, especially considering the fact that if Ajax can put one over Barcelona, then all of a sudden Celtic and Milan might be looking over their shoulders at them. Or Celtic already is. They need the 3 points. Would have to try to keep up with Ajax, and Milan need the 3 points. So at the end of the day, I think it all comes down to what Celtic and Milan can do, because we know that Barcelona, no matter who they bring, are going to be tough. But I think that if there's ever a chance for them to be taken down by Ajax, it would be this game, considering all those players that aren't even making the trip to the lowlands.
Yeah, and before we go, I'm just going to really quickly, Mark, go over Europa League that's happening on Thursday. Just the notable teams, just for people curious. I know it's not nearly as big as Champions League, but it's important to go over those fixtures. Just talk about the notable ones. No more than 3 fixtures, and then we will go. Mark, you see Ajax getting the victory at home over Barcelona with all the things you just said. I mean, I'm going to go ahead and say, why not, you know?
I don't know if they can. I'm just saying if there's ever an opportunity, it's now. But I still think there's just so much quality. I mean, you still have Xavi and Iniesta. You have the younger grown players that have come up through the squad. We've seen these players that make the jump from the B team, and they just look so comfortable even in the A team. And so you still have these players, Mascherano, you still have Neymar, you still have enough talent that I think that Ajax is still in a lot of trouble. But I think that that's why it comes down to Milan versus Celtic, because I think Barcelona will take care of business. I was just saying that if any time Ajax has a chance with so many players missing, it's now. But there's just way too much firepower, in my opinion, on this Barcelona team for Ajax to get all 3 points.
All right, and out of Group E that group seems to be kind of there's not that many notable matches really at this point in Europa League. Maccabi Tel Aviv will play Apoel from Cyprus. That's a big match there because this group is very open. Not even the team in first place is as clinched, so every team has a chance. In Group G, also, Genk out of Belgium's in first place. Dynamo Kiev is in second with 7 points. And then the team I was talking about earlier with Terrence Boyd, Rapid, they're in third place, and they still have a chance. In Group H, Sevilla, I guess you could say, are also, you know, it's interesting. Most of these groups, there's no team dominated. Also, Group H, open. And Group I, in addition, open with Lyon trying to come back and make something out of their season. They're in seventh place in the domestic league. Lazio is in second place. And this, I guess, is the most interesting group. Group K with Tottenham and Enzi, the team out of Russia that spent a lot of money and is most notable for bringing on Eto'o. Tottenham has moved on with 12 points. Enzi has 7 points. It looks like they're going to move on. Group L, AZ from Holland and PAOK from Greece are both tied with 8 points. And that's Europa League. Obviously not nearly exciting as Champions League, though. There are some big clubs, Tottenham, Fiorentina, Maccabi Tel Aviv, if you want to include them in that list. Lazio, some big clubs, Lyon and so on. So you can check that out on today. But Champions League tomorrow night, Wednesday night, very, very exciting stuff. Mark Serber, thank you so much as always, and we'll talk with you next week.
Sounds great. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Listening to Kicking It with Raphael here. That was Mark Serber. First guest, James Montague. Then we had John Johnson coming on the show. And after that, we had Noah E. Davis break down the latest in American football. So John Johnson, Noe Davis, Mark Serber, and James Montague. You can check me out on Twitter at RAPHAELG23 to discuss anything with me, ask me questions, ask me to ask questions on the show. Next week we'll have some great guests on from ESPN FC, Fox Soccer, and hopefully Goal.com. Check next week, Kicking It with Raphael, episode 11. Goodbye.